Well, it's time now, Conversations with Linda, when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, Linda Moulton Howe with us. Linda, last night with one of my guests, Mark Pinkleton, he was talking about you and Richard Doty. What did you think of Doty over the years?
Well, it was a narrow slice of time. Remember, I had signed a contract with Home Box Office on March 21st in 1983 to produce an hour for them that we were using the working title UFOs, the ET Factor. And attorney Peter Gersten, who had filed the first Freedom of Information Act request that had just become law against the CIA, NSA, NRO, DIA, all of them, trying to get UFO documents. And that was a case that went all the way to the Supreme Court because Peter Gersten was able to gather correspondence where the CIA would say, we don't have anything, but the NSA has 23 documents. And the NSA would send him a letter saying, we don't have anything, but we know the CIA has 100. And pretty soon, Gersten was able to build up quite a case. And that was the famous in camera where the attorneys for all of the intelligence agencies were saying that the documents were rightfully classified, and in the in-camera session, they were able to look at documents that were largely blacked out. You've seen Stanton Friedman's show, Nearly all blacked out. And it was that same Peter Gersten who had accomplished that, and now I'm meeting with him in New York the night that I had signed the contract with Home Box Office, and he was telling me that there was this AFOSI special agent in Albuquerque, Richard Doty, showed some correspondence who he was talking to about an exchange between a security guard at Ellsworth Air Force Base who drew his gun on some sort of a blonde-haired being, as I understood it, outside of a craft that had set down in an area of Ellsworth Air Force Base around 77, 78, and the security guard drew his gun, and instantly there was a beam, I think it was green light, sort of like laser light, hit the gun in his hand, evaporated the gun, is the story, leaving only surface warmth on his hand. And this was the story that Peter Gersten was interested in following up what he had done in Freedom of Information Act requests, and he wanted to find out who knew the most about this case, and he and Citizens Against UFO Secrecy would go and go to Ellsworth, and he said, Linda, if I set this meeting up with you, with this AFOSI agent, you can go, you can find out, and then we can all, it's win-win. Because I want to do the documentary on hard-breaking information concerning extraterrestrials and disks, and Peter Gersten and Citizens Against UFO Secrecy wanted to continue investigating as much as they could, especially in police, airline pilots, and military bases. And so that's why I went to Kirtland Air Force Base in the meeting set up by Peter Gersten. And it was in that meeting where I thought I would be there for 10 minutes, get witness names, addresses, and phone numbers so that we could follow up. And instead, that's when he reached into the desk after telling me, as we went into this big office through punch door, secret doors, that documentary that you did, A Strange Harvest, about the animal mutilations, broadsided the U.S. government. That was the phrase he used. And from there, it kept going completely in an unexpected way when he pulled this document out of the desk drawer and said, my superiors have asked me to show this to you. You can read it and you can ask questions, but you cannot take notes. And I want you to sit there. And he pointed to a chair that was in the middle of the room, which I then learned a few years later from someone. I had been videotaped the entire time in this meeting from my reaction. And some of the sentences in the paper that he showed me included, These extraterrestrial biological entities manipulated DNA in already evolving primates to create Homo sapien. All questions and mysteries about the evolution of Homo sapien on this planet have been answered, and this project is closed. And those are the kind of sentences that when you see them for the first time, at least this is the way it affected me, I just kept reading them over and over, trying to comprehend the implications of this several-page document that was essentially saying that our government knew that humans were concocted by extraterrestrials, that extraterrestrials had been terraforming and interacting with Earth life. And there was a paragraph that I've really never talked much about before, but I certainly have had it reinforced by other people that I have met since that meeting with Richard Doty, who have told me that our government has proof. I have no idea what the proof is, but that's the word they use, proof that at least three different types of extraterrestrial biological entities have terraformed and interacted with this planet for more than 270 million years. That means that humans are the latest made life form, and that we don't understand at all what is going on in the cosmos, this planet, and that that kind of document is what set me off on many more complex paths that I have written about in my first book, An Alien Harvest.
Okay, let's go to some of the calls now here for you, Linda. We shall first of all go to Albuquerque, New Mexico. Leo is with us, west of the Rockies. Leo, go ahead.
Good evening, George. Linda,
hi.
Nice to talk to you.
Hi.
I had a question and a comment, Linda. I was curious to know, the conspiracy theorist side of me is curious to know whether or not there's you've heard any mention of the island of Diego Garcia
yes.
as having been a potential landing spot for this missing plane.
Well, it's ironic you should ask that question, because in the first 48 hours or so, after the disappearance of MH370, the retired Navy captain, Mark Wood, that I did the interview tonight, he and I were talking about it, and his first thought, as somebody who dealt with tracking submarines and working on all these naval things, he says, I bet you that this is landed. It could be in Pakistan. It could have gone into or had some secret thing on that island. And so these were the kinds of discussions that we were having in the first 48 hours. I think a lot of people were wondering if 777 was diverted to land and that it might be used in some 9/11 attack. And in that particular island area is one of the few places where there would be any place to land an airplane.
Linda, there's a theory, too, that if this plane was hijacked, what if military took that plane out because they had to? And they just don't want anybody to know about it, so they just shot it down.
Why would they not want anyone to know that terrorists were taken down?
Well, you know, I happen to think that the plane in Pennsylvania during 9/11 might have been taken down by us, and we still don't comment about that either.
Oh, that Cheney said that it was, I think his strategy was if the airliner, even with people on it, has to be taken down, it will keep that airliner from crashing into the Capitol.
Yep, exactly. So what if there's that possibility? I mean, I'm convinced that either the pilots or those two people who got aboard with phony passports, stolen passports, somebody hijacked that plane.
Okay, but let's go back to a minute to this very important work that Mark Wood, the retired Navy captain, did, and the illustrations are at Earth Files. You can look at it yourself. The very fact that he's generating these overlapping circles for only one reason, and that was if there were the physical pings, remember?
Mm-hmm.
And the Inmarsat satellite, the reason why that information was so important, that they said they had new logarithms and that they were changing their opinion and said that they were convinced that this plane went south. Then the pings came off in that area off west of Perth. Well, as Mark Wood has made the point, the pings are there. What else at approximately that 37.5 frequency that is unique to the pingers, what else would have been making these three or four different ping sounds, and that he would end up looking at the doing a radius circle around each of the pings that have been reported, and where was the Inmarsat satellite track? It's coming almost right through the center of the overlapping circles. I don't think that is a coincidence. I think there is something very relevant here, and the very fact that in that he put the search grids that the drones have been on. Also, in this illustration, you can see it at Earth Files right now, and I've got it so that you can click and it blows up, and you see the Pinger 2 search grid and Pinger Detection 1 and so forth on here. And the fact that they didn't find anything still doesn't mean that where the Inmarsat satellite track a little further to the east, there might be something there. And so all I'm saying is this didn't come out of the air. This is from the hard physical facts of those pings that finally stopped being heard. Remember at exactly when they said they've gone as long as they could.
As they could. Yeah, probably longer than they thought.
Yeah, so this is physical evidence that needs to be considered. And the math of where these pings were and that Inmarsat satellite, the very fact that that track, which, remember, it was doing handshakes with that airplane.
Yeah, I know, but it doesn't explain why the 370 went all over the place. I mean,
where it took that sharp left
sharp turns and stuff. Clearly, it was under the control and direction of somebody in that cockpit, whether it was the pilot or hijackers.
That was what the interview with Mark went down to. If they had any destination that would make any sense, it would be trying to get to Perth, maybe to do a 9/11 or something.
Yes.
And who knows what happened. But the hypothesis is that it made that sharp turn left as soon as they had shut the transponder off and said, good night, Malaysian 370. And then it went straight, almost a 90 degrees straight west, and then started going south.
Let's go to Duke in Janesville, Wisconsin, east of the Rockies. Duke, good morning.
Hello, thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir. Very good.
Hello, George, Linda. Kind of let your imagination run here for just a minute. What if that plane was taking evasive moves? You know, perhaps that plane was being played with by UFOs, or perhaps that plane had been taken over by a UFO and the people aboard it were abducted. And the plane just flew until it ran out of gas and fell into the sea.
Yeah. Linda, can we rule out this very strange possibility?
Definitely not. There are at least two important radar and multiple witnessed events. One was 53 Kinross Air Force Base, Michigan, that has been written about. The Air Force has done reports. This is where there was that F-89 jet, and there is this big UFO, and they have them both on radar. Excuse me. And they see on radar that the UFO engulfs the F-89 jet that just disappears with two pilots in it, and that they have never, ever come back. That was really dramatic, and that's why Kinross, Michigan, is one of the strong pieces on the puzzle relating to UFOs about, was it a hostile act? What was the intent and never returning the pilots? Well, that was 53, jumped to October 78. That's where Frederick Valentik was off the coast of Melbourne, Australia, and he was describing that he was seeing this big light, and he was flying sort of toward it, and then all of a sudden there seems to be tension in his voice, and this is all being recorded in a radio control, traffic control office. And the last sound on that tape, because J. Allen Hynek himself told me about listening to it, and it was J. Allen Hynek who said, Linda, right at the end of the Frederick Valentich transmission about this large disc-shaped light or so coming toward his plane, was, it sounded like soup cans rolling around in the bottom of an empty oil drum, quote-unquote, J. Allen Hynek, listening to that tape. So he disappeared. That plane and that person never was returned. Was it a hostile act? These are the questions. Is it something else that we don't understand? Those are two very important. And there are others where there has been evidence that UFOs have engulfed planes in the air.
Strange stuff. Let's go to Tom, truck driving in Ohio now. Tom, go ahead. Thank you.
Tom? Hi, George. Linda.
Hi, Tom.
I'm driving down to Marietta again. That's my local route.
There you go.
I got a question and a comment about UFOs. Back in 74, me and a friend of mine saw an unusual-looking light off the coast of Hollywood, Florida. This must have been around almost midnight. We came out, we were shooting pole, came out and saw something over the ocean. And at first, you know, it looked like a blimp. And I was trying to figure out why a blimp was out there that time of night. And it got closer to land. It wasn't making any noise or anything. But we could see it was writing something. And as it got closer, I thought maybe it was a Japanese blimp or something, because it was writing some kind of glyphs. I couldn't understand it. Anyways, we were watching it for a while, commenting on it. So what the heck is that?
Are you saying it was writing?
2 minutes later, a couple of Navy jets came in, started circling this thing, and then the object just started speeding up, made no sound, started speeding up and just left, like in a line. It didn't zigzag or anything. It just zipped right out of there and left those jets behind. Not a sound. But I was just wondering, Linda, you ever heard of a UFO that looked kind of like a blimp?
Sir, did you say it was writing, R-I-T-I-N-G, glyphs?
Yes, exactly.
Meaning that it looked like it was moving in the sky and leaving a glowing pattern of symbols?
No, it was more like it actually looked like a blimp, like the Goodyear blimp. Only, you know, maybe the Fuji tire blimp, right, the Japanese symbols. But when we got a better look at it, the symbols weren't Japanese. There was some kind of, hieroglyphs of some kind.
Okay, hieroglyphs have been described in many instances. And if I understand, then you're seeing something that is a blimp shape, and it has some kind of hieroglyphs, like written on it, carved on it.
That's amazing, Linda.
If that man is listening, would you please email me at earthfiles@earthfiles.com so that maybe you and I can talk about exactly what the glyphs look like? I would appreciate that. earthfiles@earthfiles.com. Thanks, George.
Okay, Linda, we're going to come back and take final phone calls with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, I'll be off Dave Schrader filling in for me, so make sure you're part of that program. And when we come back in a moment with Linda Moulton Howe, we shall take final phone calls here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. Linda, I'm going to have an assignment for you, by the way. Back in 1967, and he's 64 now, two brothers took a picture in Mount Clemens, Michigan, by Selfridge Air Force Base, of a UFO, which Dr. J. Allen Hynek investigated. He went there, and he said that he believes the pictures were authentic. One of the brothers is still alive. He's 64 years old. I want you to track him down for us.
Okay.
And see if he'll admit to you whether that was real or a hoax. His brother died. But just Google Mount Clemens, Michigan, 1967 UFO case, And then you'll get the fellow's name. His name was Daniel Jarislaw. He's in St. Clair Shores, Michigan, now.
Well, I'll tell you, if J. Allen Hynek said that from his point of view,
it was authentic.
That it was authentic, I would say right now, I would guess that would be true because he was very critical. And remember back then, we're not talking about digital, and we're talking about film, and it was very much harder to do any kind of hoaxing.
That's right. Now, they were 17 years old at the time. He's 64. You know, I would love for him to tell you on tape,
right,
I hoaxed it or it's real.
Okay, I'll check into it for sure. And Michigan is not too far from Toronto, and I've had a lot of people from Toronto and Canada asking me about the Modern Knowledge Tour up there. 2014 is the first time they've ever done it, and I think it's an exciting idea. In this particular, the Toronto version of the tour, which is going across most of the provinces of Canada, that we will be at the Ontario Science Center. Richard Dolan will be there, Michael Tellinger and I, and we will be speaking on June 6th, 2014, a little more than a month from now. And at earthfiles.com, right at the top of my headlines page, I have a conference list of where I will be speaking. And this Modern Knowledge Tour, it is an experiment that I think sounds wonderful, of people who do various investigations into phenomena making their way across the provinces of Canada and doing presentations in different cities. And in Toronto is where I will be, and I've been having a lot of people ask. So I hope you will all go to earthfiles.com and click on the registration. It's a hot link. And that if you can make it, please come and introduce yourself, shake my hand, because I think these are events that are extremely important for everybody to try to share these days.
Sandpoint, Idaho, Garth is with us. Garth, thanks for holding. Go ahead.
Yeah. Hey, Linda, how's it going?
Well, what are you up to?
Sure. Right. Okay. So we lived in Bremerton, Washington, some time back, about 15 years ago, and there was a lot of was listening to the show earlier, and you were talking about loud noises and booms and stuff like that. Right. Okay. And as you know, and on the Kitsap Peninsula there on the Puget Sound, they have the naval base, also the nuclear submarine base there. And I lived out on the Kitsap Peninsula. And there were these loud noises that would, at night, that would, they were very pronounced. And they would
crackle through the air, wouldn't they?
Yeah, yeah, but only at night, and sometimes it almost seemed like, not like an anomaly or something would happen randomly, but, almost like we thought, we were thinking that maybe it was like some sort of underground excavation or something like that, and that may be, you know, completely ridiculous, but it was certainly very dull, and I can't even imagine the equipment that could make that kind of noise. I've been around the block a few times, and it wasn't like a sonic boom, something or some sort of atmospheric anomaly or something. This thing was coming from underground.
Right.
Well,
that is one of the confusions in this phenomena, is that many people will say it is coming from below my feet. I can feel it. It's vibrating. It's vibrating the floors. Other people will insist up and down, no, it was up in the sky. And the strangest part of this is, whatever is causing this sound phenomenon, it can be so focused or so widespread. from a house to five counties. And I don't exactly begin to understand what we're dealing with, except that it may be something related to changes in our earth that is translating through things like infrasound into the audible and back out. In an area where there's a big Navy shipyard, and I know the Bremerton area, who knows what any military installation at any given time might be building underground. There's most military bases have huge underground installations. So when it comes to military bases and hearing strange sounds, it's hard to know. But when you go out into the land between, let's say, Fort Knox and Louisville, Kentucky, and that people have heard not only booms, but have seen these big flashes of light there right before booms. And that's just an example. It's far away from oceans. It's in an area where, yes, you could say Fort Knox, but the people know what Fort Knox sounds like when they're doing cannon runs, and say that what has been in the Louisville area and Fort Knox has been completely different. And I'm giving that as an example that inland, there's been as many boom reports in Louisville, Illinois, Indiana, Kentucky, Missouri, Arkansas, as there have been on the coast.
Linda, let's take a few more calls here. Boy, this hour's going by fast.
It really does.
My gosh. Let's go to Tim in Indianapolis. Timothy, you're up with us.
Hey, it's an honor to speak with you guys, and I'd like to thank you for all the hard work you guys do. My question real quick is, with the Earth having a magnetic pole shift and these sounds that we're hearing, would it be like we're in a big MRI machine? And, I mean, that would cause disruption. And, I mean, it seems logical. I'm not a rocket scientist or anything. And then, is there any update on the Baltic Sea, the object there?
Okay.
Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, and thank you. Thank you for appreciating our work. First of all, pole shift. There is not an active, instantaneous pole shift. We could go for another 500 years, and the poles would still stay where they are, the North Pole and the South Pole. But there are indications that there are changes. As I've been talking about, there's definitely changes in the core. They may or may not accelerate or have impact on what has been a natural variation of pole changes on this planet so many times. That's just a known fact. This Earth will change polarity. When that happens, what exactly will occur for birds and animals that depend on magnetic fields, we don't know. But right now, on April 25th, 2014, the poles have not shifted. So that's really clear to keep that in mind. On the Baltic Sea image, I've corresponded not too long ago with the X-Explorer team, and they are frustrated again about needing more funding to do more refined and sophisticated research in that very murky Baltic Sea water. And they're hoping this spring that they may be able to do something that will truly push this research a lot further. That's the way Dennis and Peters told me. So they can only do the kind of work that they need to do with clarity somewhere around, probably coming up now. I think they said they were going to try something more in May. And I stay in touch with them, and I will definitely, if I can get new information and do another interview about another discovery, I will report it at Earth Files and on Coast.
Yakima, Washington, we go. Jeremy's with us, west of the Rockies. Jeremy, good morning.
Hi, George, Linda, first-time caller, long-time listener. Okay. Very grateful to be on the line.
Good to have you with us.
My main question is, I've seen a lot of things here in Yakima, orbs, stuff like that, and where I live, I could see the what do you call it? I'm sorry. The military base, or we call it the Yakima military base. Well, anyways, I see a lot of flares. Was what I would describe them as. And what they do is they blink in, blink out, and then they're really bright, and they kind of move around, but they're always above the hill right there. And I was wondering if you've seen anything about that, and I'll take my answer off the line. Thank
okay.
you.
Okay, sure thing. I haven't, Linda. Have you?
Well, lights, moving lights, are such a part of this, we'll call it strange phenomena, and I have been in Hestdal in Norway with scientists studying lights that move around and pop around up in the treeless, high, all rock area above Hestdal. I personally have seen orange lights moving over crops in England and Wiltshire at night. Others have seen them moving in the day, flickering and fluttering like a mirror. There are all kinds of hypotheses about 3-inch or up to 12-inch diameter glowing spheres related directly to extraterrestrial technology defined this way. They may be programmed plasmas, and that the programmed plasma can interact with our environment and be programmed just like we would do computers, only it would be plasma. And that it has the ability to download and upload information, monitor, do tasks, and something that humans are not capable of doing. And that has been part of the phenomena, we'll call it high strangeness phenomena, some of it related to ETs and disks, for such a long time that I'm reminded of a book about very strange events that have been documented around the world. And one of them was in, I believe it was Tibet, and it was an American couple, and they were on a path up in the Himalayas, and they saw a light, exactly what you're asking about. It was small, it was about baseball size, glowing, sort of gold. And to their amazement, the light transformed right before their eyes into a full-bodied male human who had on some kind of a cloak, and the being or whatever kept walking on the path in front of them. And they didn't run. I would want it to run and say, I just saw you turn out of a light. Where did you come from? Who are you? But they only have written this up as something that they saw firsthand. And I think they're probably describing exactly what they saw. But is it dimensional, a dimensional transport? Is it exactly like some of the sci-fi stories that if we only understood how to bend space-time, that theoretically is possible, that you could move point to point through the cosmos, and if you move point to point, you might see exactly that, a light that is a circle that opens up, and then somebody comes out of it.
Let's go to Bob in Dayton, Ohio, on the wild card line. Bob, go ahead.
Hi, George and Linda. I just have an observation that in all of the time since this unfortunate disappearance of this plane, I found a map on the internet of the globe, and I noticed that all around the world there are about, now I may be wrong, Linda can verify this, I'm sure. There are around 10 areas which are similar in description to the Bermuda Triangle.
Magnetic anomalies.
Right. One of them is about 1,500 to 2,000 miles off Perth. The other is basically up off Japan. Now, I know the one in Japan is probably not that proximal to where the flight path of this flight was headed or was made. But the other one near Perth or off of Perth seems to be somewhat near where the trajectory, the odd trajectory of this plane was made. Now, as I say, I'm not theorizing that this is what happened, but my question is, I think, frankly, it's a little bit unusual that I haven't heard in all of the time of the discussions of everyone about the theories of what happened to this flight, that no one has mentioned the possibility that maybe this flight was caught up in one of these areas, such as usually is reported about up in Alaska or the Bermuda Triangle.
Well, actually, we just had a report on last week about that.
Oh, did you?
A huge story. They call it electronic fog, and that it engulfed this plane, and it crashed, they say, but that this fog did it. Linda, we're almost out of time.
Was that remote viewing that you're describing? That they remote viewed? Because nobody knows for sure about electronic fog. But let me just say, where does anomalous magnetic, let's say magnetic field collapses on the planet in a dozen places, where does that leave off and the UFO phenomena starts or the other way around? Because UFO phenomena and these magnetic collapsing lines, Philip J. Corso, the lieutenant colonel in the Army who worked for General Arthur Trudeau in the Pentagon, in his very important book, The Day After Roswell, in private conversations with me, more in private conversation, said that it was very important to understand that on our planet that there were magnetic field lines that would collapse, and that extraterrestrial intelligences could use the naturally collapsing magnetic field lines to enter and exit our planet.
Just like portals. Linda, thanks so much. We'll talk to you next month. For Dan Galante, Nathan Staton, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, George Knapp, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.